ebook publishers and marketing services company Just Imagine It, Inc. presents Get Behind Me, Now Stay There, a new fun-filled, informative podcast available on iTunes and right here locally on KSKQ Ashland, Oregon, 89.5 FM. Art and entertainment news and views. Today's podcast is brought to you by the fine folks at Downpour.com, the one stop for all your audio and digital book needs. Join the Downpour Audiobook Club and save up to 50% on digital downloads, exclusive member-only deals and promotions with no commitment, and you can cancel at any time. Only $12.99 per month. That's Downpour.com. On this episode, Bobby Seale relives his day as a civil rights leader. The rock band Adult Toys talk to us from the Inland Empire while waiting for a pizza delivery. And Orson's Shadow exposes the private worlds of public figures in our audiobook feature right after the news you want to know.
And she grew up right with them Indiana boys on an Indiana night.
Hello, I'm Charlie Stanton.
I'm Jerry Renfro.
I'm Sarah Simerson.
I'm Chrissy McIntyre.
I'm Maya Seligman. Here's a look at our top stories in the art and entertainment world. The casting is now up for discussion for the 1960s hit Gilligan's Island.
Now, I can't wait to see
what?
This. There you go.
I hear that it's Charlie, your daughter Casey's favorite show in the world.
You know, it is. And, you know, because it's, well, everybody likes Gilligan. It's such a, it's a silly show, but it's so much fun and it's non-threatening. And, you know, and they do all these crazy, these things, you know, and then when you look back on it, see, I remember when the show came out. And, you know, it first came out, it was in black and white, and then they added, you know, into the color, and it's one of those things that I'm trying to draw a correlation of, Star Trek would be another correlation like that, where when it was originally out, it was not all that popular.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Gilligan's Island was popular for a couple of years, and then, you know, then it faded, just like Star Trek was only popular for a couple of years, and it faded. And then it's got this, you know, like with young folks, like, you know, my daughter, it's got this cult status now, and you know people love it. Like they love Star Trek, and now they make all these movies out of it.
Well, and the interesting thing is that there were so many reruns of it. Like it ended up continuing on, but the show was developed during the days before actors were paid residuals.
You know, my daughter was just saying, you know, that to me the other day that you know the thing about Gilligan's Island that's cool, and it kind of applies to some other shows too, like Friends. Is that, you know, everybody has it's got all these seven lovely, you know, lovable characters, and everybody can identify with one of them, you know?
Right, like I'm a Skipper kind of guy.
Right.
Or I'm Ginger or Marianne. That was one of the great
pop culture
questions.
That was the biggest debate in
Ginger or Marianne.
Yeah, because actually right now, that's one of the issues, is they're trying to find the best character to, best actress to play the character Ginger. And so the ideas for potentials that Caprice Crane had. She's the daughter of Tina Louise, who was the original actress.
Who played Ginger.
She was saying Jennifer Lawrence or Beyonce or Christina Hendricks were the ideas that she came up with.
That's a big spread. Yeah. Jennifer Lawrence or Beyonce.
I can't see
them competing for many roles.
You know what? This kind of struck me, but you know, I think Jennifer Lawrence could be Ginger and Beyonce could be Marianne.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
I think in that article, wasn't she talking about like updating it for the modern era, like Gilligan's Island in the modern era?
Yeah. And it was funny because there's actually so Caprice says, my mom was constantly coming on to the professor on the show and he was never into it. So the professor could be the gay one. It would explain a lot. It would be fun if they shake it up, make it and make it worthy of today's times.
That would be cool.
You know, because the professor was a character who was obviously oblivious to the two hot single lady castaways.
Yeah, and he couldn't have a gay character really in that era, but you certainly could now. And that would certainly, you know, so you got some diversity. You've got, you know, like an African-American member, you got a gay member, you got, you know, you could do more with it these days. I'd watch it, I guess. Of course, what wouldn't I watch? So,
I would definitely go see the movie, and I like the whole idea that they're doing it because it's a feel good thing, and it's fresh. It's something that the whole family can watch it and get something out of, and the little love triangles they can build in there, whatever the little nuances that they have in there are subtle enough to where you know anyone can watch it. And there was a hot debate between, you know, Ginger or Marianne, right? It's like, you know, who is, you know, what kind of guy are you? Are you a
Ginger guy or a Marianne?
Yeah. Are you a Ginger man? Are you a no pun intended, are you a Marianne, right? And I would always say, I'm going for Mrs. Howe, man. Come on.
Go for the money. That's what's about.
Oh, love it. Best me an old fashioned.
Yeah, the archetypes, you know, it makes me think of my favorite short story by Stephen Crane, The Open Boat. And, you know, which is kind of like, you know, maybe could have been an inspiration for Gilligan's Island. You know, they're on a boat out in the sea. You know, another thing, too, that came up with Gilligan's Island that we didn't talk about here, they had a reality TV show. It was just like Survivor that came out like actually, I guess it was 6 years ago.
What, do you remember the name?
Gilligan's Island.
They made a reality show.
Yeah,
there's 14 people all together, you know, like two teams, you know, and they had each character on each team. And then they had to do like Survivor stunts to stay on the show.
Was it a 3-hour
tour? Yeah, it was a 3-hour tour.
I mean, I love that song. I mean, let's hear something
right
now.
Oh, no, it's going to be stuck in my head.
Sit right back and hear a tale of faithful trip. Yeah.
With Gilligan?
The skipper to the
millionaire.
Oh,
that's going to be so stuck in my head now.
Well, you know, I think it's funny.
The movie star.
Professor and Marianne here on Gilligan's Island.
I think it's fascinating, man, that they didn't make the cut because they don't get residuals because they were right on the line.
Before that.
Before. And they were one of the shows that, you know. And
that made that possible.
And the Brady Bunch was another one.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed in the article about this is that none of the actors from Gilligan's Island got any residuals from all the reruns, which were massive. They were huge, and they're still huge.
Still going on. Yep.
I already said that.
Yeah. What I'm saying is that what I think is fascinating about that is that Brady Bunch was another one.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, but they were all done by the same guy.
Sherwood Schwartz.
And when they rewrote the law because of that, so actors got paid on residuals, and it was up to him. He could have included
could have backdated it.
But he wouldn't do it.
So he screwed over his own, the people that made him a success. And because you look like the cast of Seinfeld, cast of Friends, you know, what will be the cast of Modern Family. You know, these people are set for life, essentially, from the residuals. You know?
I wonder how much they get, and if it's by the episode or what. That'd be really interesting.
Yeah, there's a whole calculation based on how many times it plays and where it plays and how much they get. Sometimes, for some people, it's very small. But for, like, the cast of Friends, where they're on every episode, I mean, those people never have to work again. Jerry Seinfeld talked about that he said, I don't ever have to work.
They did the calculation. Seinfeld was on for 9 years, and it went into syndication, obviously. And they were to talk to Seinfeld about it. You know, what's he going to do next? And, you know, he goes, well, I don't need the money.
Yeah.
And the calculation for Jerry Seinfeld was that at the time when he left the show, he was in his 30s, and now he's probably in his middle 40s or, you know, pushing 50.
Late 40, early 50. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. And he will make $1 billion by the time he is 55 years old, just off residuals.
Just from the residuals. Not counting what he got paid per episode while the show was actually going on.
So that's just coming from reruns.
It shows that if you were an actor and you were in one of those shows, you'd want that show to be a success.
Definitely.
You would want that to be something that would be a rerun.
Yeah. Can you imagine how bitter they must be? Like, you know, Bob Crane Bob Denver and you know, the people from the Brady Bunch, Florence Henderson. I would be very bitter. I think if I was on the last show to not get it, you know, like the next show that comes along gets it, that would be tough.
How'd you like to, but that's just the way it was back then. And they just happened to be on that line, you know, and You know, I mean, look at the, you know, I Love Lucy. It's probably the most, you know, the most popular show that's in reruns all around the world and has been since the 50s, you know, and Fred and Ethel don't get, they don't get
it. Vitamin
anything.
To Vegemin. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know what the millionaire's favorite game is, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Monopoly.
Yeah, they learned early.
Yeah, exactly.
Didn't Mr. Howe and Mrs. Howe play Monopoly on Gilligan's Island?
Like make their own version of it? I don't know. I don't know if that happened. But, you know, if they did, hopefully they played by the correct rules. Now, did you all play Monopoly growing up?
Yeah, yeah. So I continue to play it.
Who didn't? I love Monopoly still to this day. Interesting thing, though, I found an article, and most people don't play Monopoly the correct way.
What do we do wrong?
Okay, now everybody's got house rules. Like, okay, when you played, did you get money for landing on free parking?
Yes.
That's not in the rules at all. That's like a house rule that somehow everybody adopted. But the big rule that actually changes the entire way Monopoly is played that people generally don't follow is that when a player lands on a property, if they choose not to buy it or don't have the money to buy it, it's actually supposed to go up for auction. Oh. And the other players in the game can then bid on buying it. It really changes the dynamic of the game because sometimes you'll maybe not buy a property because, you know, you want to save your money for something else. It really does change the outcome of the game. Another rule that a lot of people that seems to get ignored for some reason, I don't know, is you can't loan money. You can't borrow it from another player. You can't borrow it from the bank.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
You know, I could see where it would speed up the game, too, because, you know, like a lot of Monopoly, like my strategy, and it's you're always, you know, you roll the dice, the game starts, you're starting to have fun, and you're like, oh, I hope I land on Park Place, or I hope I land on the railroad, or I hope, you know, whatever your favorite property is. And then everyone's always going for free parking, you know, when you get a fine, you know.
You put the money in the free parking.
You put the money in the free parking. So we've been playing it incorrectly for all these years.
Yeah.
We just didn't read the rules.
Yeah, it's one of those. The free parking one is every time I've ever played with somebody else, they've always done that. Almost to the point where it's become like it is in the rules, but it's not. Mm-hmm. I mean, who really reads the rules anymore?
Let's ask the burning question here, Jerry. I mean, okay, everyone's played Monopoly. You know, it's an American institution. When you play Monopoly, and don't tell me you don't, everyone has a favorite symbol. Who are you, Maya?
So, Charlie, I'd say the boat would be my favorite.
I'm always the car.
You're always the car.
Yep.
Cyrus?
Because I like to run over the dog.
The hat.
Aww.
Like the hat.
You're the hat. Dang, I like the hat as well.
Mm. Nobody likes the iron, huh?
Well, they got a new one out, too. A cat.
Yeah, and then
they just added a cat.
They replaced the iron. Mm. That's because nobody liked it. And we just proved it right here. The scientific survey of four people in a room proved that nobody likes the iron.
Wow.
Personally, I hate that game.
Cyrus loves it.
I do. Yeah.
I like it myself, too. I haven't played in a long time.
I don't know.
I like it when I win. Mm. I hate it when I lose.
How do you know? It lasts about 5 days. Like, it's too long.
Yeah, well, these,
not if you play it properly.
Yeah, if you use the real rules. I was surprised to find when I read Jerry's story. I was like,
I actually knew it.
Of course you did, Renthro. Of course you did.
He knows everything.
I did.
I did not know it.
You didn't know about the auction rule?
No, I didn't. Although I probably, you know, I mean, I have cheated at Monopoly so much in my
the truth comes out.
Yeah, so I probably was, you know, doing this and thinking that I was getting one over on somebody, but it was actually a, you know, fair game. Mm-hmm. But you know, when Cyrus plays Monopoly, he likes to be the banker. Isn't that correct, Cyrus?
That is, yeah. I love being a banker. And here are some movies you can bank on. Chrissy's got some more on that.
Yes, well, it's the start of 2014, so we have to look forward to all of the delights that Hollywood is going to entertain us with.
And there are many this year.
There are many. First one up is Guardians of the Galaxy, which should be this summer's surprise hit. I'm saying should. I don't want you to make any personal bets based on what I'm saying because, you know, if you lose money, it's not my fault. Don't sue me. But it should be good based on the fact that this is the same team that did the breakout hit Iron Man. And the difference,
I have heard
of
that movie. Iron Man. Yeah.
It's kind of, whatever.
It's kind of a big deal.
Kind of a big deal. And then they have the Avengers, that whole thing, right? So it's going to be distributed by Walt Disney, and it's the Marvel thing. And also director James Gunn is going to be attached to the project, which is very good. And it's going to open on August 1st of 2014 in the U.S. Jerry, you probably are all ready for this movie, right?
Absolutely. It's on this calendar. As soon as every time they leak a screenshot or anything like that, I've been looking at it, and I think it's going to do surprisingly well. It's one of the lesser known properties that Marvel has. You know, it's not huge like Captain America or anything like that, but it's got a great storyline that I think is going to translate very well to the big screen.
Excellent. Well, they gotta scrape everything out because, I mean, these other movies are so huge. They might as well give it a shot, right? Guardians of the Galaxy might, like you say, might just be the big thing.
I think it could be the surprise. Yeah, I think it's going to be one of those ones that very few people know about and all their friends tell them to go see it.
Right. Well, the Jack Ryan vehicle, you know, the Tom Clancy books, Clear and Present Danger and Patriot Games, all those movies.
Yeah, I like Paul.
They're
Edwin,
redoing
Ben
it yeah. with that hottie from Star Trek, Chris Pine.
Yeah. Like,
I will totally – I don't – care what he says, frankly. I'll go and see that. I don't.
You know what, Chris, I think he's a great actor.
Chrissy, you know what? He is a good actor. I saw him in Star Trek. He is the guy in the Paul McCartney video.
Yeah, Queenie Eye. Yeah.
The Queenie Eye. He's the guy that sits there with a cap on, just looking cool.
Right. Yeah. He doesn't have to say anything. Like, you know, you run around with a gun, bring the story forward. Great. Fine. Hollywood insiders don't think this is going to resonate with moviegoers, but I definitely would see this movie because I love, the Tom Clancy books, and I love this whole series, and I like that they're going to continue with it. So it's going to be Jack Ryan, Shadow Recruit, directed by Kenneth Branagh.
I'm getting the impression that you're quite taken with Chris Pine.
Yeah, that's now, it. I mean, it's
from earlier shows, Chrissy, we also know that you have quite an affection for Ben Affleck.
So, yeah, well, in the 70s look, yeah. Oh. Not in the regular look. So the 70s Argo Ben Affleck, yeah. That's bring it on.
And the Jack Ryan character was played by Ben Affleck at one point, correct?
With or without beard.
Right.
Was it?
Yeah.
No, it was played by Alec Baldwin.
Well, yes, but they also did one. Ben Affleck also did one.
Yeah,
as
Ben
well.
Affleck took over for Harrison Ford.
Harrison Ford.
And that was like everybody got pissed off about it because Harrison Ford, you know, he was just starting to get old. You know, he hadn't passed his, you know, he hadn't gotten, you know, but they made a big deal out of his age. Harrison Ford was kind of offended, and they put Ben Affleck in there. And then fans of the series were kind of divided. You know, it was like Van Halen, you know, people got pissed off about Sammy Hagar.
Yeah, you know, because like, I know when it first came out, the Jack Ryan is a character, it was A Hunt for Red October. Alec Baldwin was the first one. And everybody, and even Alec Baldwin himself said, you know, he really dropped the ball on that one. He didn't know that franchise movies were going to be that big of a deal. People weren't doing franchise movies back then.
Yeah.
And he was offered, you know, the franchise deal to be like Robert
Downey
Jr.
Like a multi-picture
Jr.
deal.
You know, yeah.
Yeah.
And he turned it down.
Oh, wow. Yeah, because that was the
Harrison Ford knew about doing franchise movies. He did the Star Wars thing. I mean, he knew, like, this is a, you know, possible... You get a hit, you keep going.
Yeah, but I think with Harrison Ford, I don't think it was entirely his choice. I think Cyrus pointed out, you know, it was like Harrison Ford was kind of on that backside heading into old age at that point, and they wanted to go younger. I think that's one of the concerns possibly here is that, you know, you've read the novels, I've read the novels. You know, the character Jack Ryan is kind of like, what, an analyst who's forced to deal with unreasonable circumstances. And Chris Pine, the way I've seen in the trailers, it looks more like he's a ninja in a suit, you know, kind of thing. So I think that might be because it's kind of a gamble, I think, for Viacom. You know, you got a great director, you got a great actor, but are they staying true to the character?
Yeah. Well, I mean, Alec Baldwin did it a long time ago. That movie came out. He didn't look like an older statesman analyst either, frankly. He was a young guy. He looked great.
Yeah.
I didn't really get the
sense
that
he was fighting
some
ninjas and, you know, shooting at people
and
stuff like
that. Well,
but
that's the way
the
movies go now. Well, I mean, yeah, every movie has a ninja, for God's sake. You know, you can't get away from these karate chopping scenes.
That is correct. Only a ninja can sneak up on another ninja.
That's right.
All right.
What else we got there?
We got Aaron Paul is going to be in a movie called Need for Speed, which is DreamWorks Studio adapting the Electronic Arts game franchise. And people have not heard of this. The movie insiders are saying, it's probably not going to happen so much. Because of the, I've never heard of it. I had to look it up. But I don't play Electronic Arts games either. I don't play any of those games. So maybe people that are interested in those kind of games will probably go check it out.
don't even know what Electronic Arts are.
It's a company. It's those, like, you
EA
know.
Sport, oh, like gotcha. EA.
Uh-huh. EA. Arts. All the.
It's like the third or fourth best known racing franchise in, right. in video games. Mm. So it's popular, but it's not the biggest one. So it wouldn't surprise me if, you know, word of mouth is going to be a bigger factor there, too.
Mm-hmm. More people still want to see the Fast and Furious 7, but unfortunately, sadly, very sadly, Paul Walker had an untimely tragic death this year. So they're still kind of figuring out what to do with that movie. So I think it was mostly in the can, right? And Jerry, you probably know about that.
I believe so. Yeah, I believe they were midway through when he passed. So I don't know how they're gonna deal with that. If they're gonna recast it, reshoot it, it still remains to be seen. But I think yeah, you were right that like more people were talking about that than Need for Speed. So that says a lot about how well it's gonna possibly do.
Need for Speed. That's that's the Top Gun quote.
Oh yeah, I feel the need.
The need for speed.
Yeah.
What are some other films that are on the list?
Yeah, another one that's a. God, we talk about a remake. Godzilla. They're making Godzilla again.
Yep. Which,
and it's a huge budget, $160 million budget. And to go see Godzilla, I don't know about you guys, but honestly, I feel like this thing has been played out. So I don't know how they're going to make this exciting for
Seems
people.
Seems like moviegoers aren't going to be very interested necessarily.
No, they're not. Because it's on Rotten Tomatoes, they said only 6,256 people on Rotten Tomatoes, which is a huge website, said they would wanted to see the film at the time of the writing. So,
from what I've heard about it, you look at Godzilla on the outside, you know, okay, a giant lizard destroys the city. How do you get 90 minutes out of that every 10 years or whatever? But from my understanding, they're really playing this more like Godzilla plays a smaller role. It's more of a character drama, and then that just also happens to feature a gigantic lizard that destroys things. So
that elevator pitch sounds horrible, Jerry. How did you get that made?
I don't know. Somebody owed somebody a favor, maybe. Well, who knows?
Listen, it's a nuanced piece. Godzilla is just a side character. Like, he's going to be there to work.
You know, franchises, they work, you know?
I guess.
He's just in the background, yeah. You know, they have the people talking, like, close-ups on the face, and in the background, buildings are being destroyed.
Well, you know.
Photobombed, you know?
Godzilla, yeah.
Throughout the whole movie.
Godzilla like, photobombed.
A variable that really affects the success of a film is certainly who is cast in it and what actors are playing those roles. That's got to be a big one.
That's true. And here are some recent casting decisions in Hollywood that drew cheers from audiences. Drew Barrymore in the movie Blended. This doesn't seem like a big deal, but Drew Barrymore is one of the only female leads who Adam Sandler really has a chemistry with on film. So Warner Brothers has released a trailer for the African-set romantic comedy, and the movie will be staying close to the Happy Madison formula for success. And so there's no denying that this is a casting genius because, you know, the other films that these two were in, The Wedding Singer and 50 First Dates, were both huge successes.
The Wedding Singer, oh my gosh.
Well, that was such a great...
That's a cult classic, dude.
Oh, absolutely. And 50 First Dates is still probably my favorite rom-com of all time. They really did have good
rom-com.
What is rom-com?
Romantic comedy. Oh. I haven't heard that before. That's really funny. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I think they were great in that. And it's good to see that he's going back to his roots because I really think the Happy Madison has not been good for years. So I'm glad to see Sandler finally getting back to what worked for him.
Yeah, he's had a couple of flops, you know.
Couple. Movies, yeah.
Jack and Jill, anyone?
All right, so hopefully we can get back to, you know, the Adam Sandler that we all know and love. Another big casting decision, Matthew McConaughey, you know, the hottest actor in Hollywood. Christopher Nolan was able to nab him for his new movie Interstellar. So this is going to be a very exciting casting choice. We're all going to be looking forward to this movie. McConaughey, of course, has experience with outer space. He starred opposite of Jodie Foster in Contact. And you know, once again, he gets to prove that his career is turned around with a great role on the big screen.
Smart. Very smart. Yeah, because Matthew McConaughey's career has definitely had definitely taken a hit. I mean, Ghosts of Girlfriends Past. But I'm really glad. I mean, I just got Killer Joe. He was stellar.
Right.
I can't wait to see the Dallas Buyers Club. And then to team him up with Christopher Nolan in this movie.
He did his Superman movies. And
I think this is going to be not just stellar, but interstellar.
Definitely. Yeah, The Lincoln Lawyer was another one.
It was a good one.
Great. Yeah, and in Mud, I mean, Charlie can tell you all about Mud.
Mud was fantastic, and I strongly recommend everyone go see that. Now here, I just seen this, Cyrus, and we were talking about this earlier. When we were talking about the Mockingjay, and I said that, you know, they were doing another one, and they had cast a big woman in it that I couldn't put my finger on, but she was like Amy Adams, but, you know, older and bigger star.
Julianne Moore. Oh, yeah.
That's right. Yeah, Julianne Moore. She'll be playing President Alma Coyne, who leads the district's rebellion against the Capitol. This is a huge pickup. You know, Julianne Moore is going to be starring opposite Jennifer Lawrence. And
she's already gotten 4 Oscar nominations.
Yeah, she's got 4 Oscar nominations under her belt. So the two of them together are going to make movie magic.
I think that's going to be awesome. I loved her in Children of Men. Actually, a number the Kids Are All Right she did a couple years ago with Mark Ruffalo was great. And she's got another one that just came on Netflix called The English Teacher. What Maisie Knew. That's it. Where she plays an aging rock star. It's in my list to watch. I just haven't got to see it yet.
Yeah, but she was also in Don Juan.
Really?
She played the older woman and quite smashingly.
Well, now I definitely got to see that.
Well, and here's the final one. And I know, Jerry, you're going to love this. Chrissy, she's going to be all for this. Ben Affleck. Batman versus Superman.
Yeah.
So, you know, we can't say enough about this choice. Affleck, just like McConaughey, you know, his career has kind of had some ups and downs, and he's rebounded with Argo as a director and a producer. But he still hasn't gotten that respect, you know, of being a great actor. And in this movie, with director Zack Snyder, he will have that opportunity to portray the Caped Crusader, who is a little bit more world-weary, you know, an older superhero. So this is going to be a great movie. And, you know, I've been trying to think about, like, how this is going to work. You know, Batman versus Superman. It seems like, you know, Superman's got, you know, crazy superpowers. I don't know how.
Kryptonite gloves.
I guess that's the comics.
We'll see what happens there. And the real, you know, acid test on this whole thing is going to be, you know, if you want to throw down some money, man, and who is going to get their seat first in the theater? Will it be Jerry Renfro or Chrissy McIntyre?
And I've said it before, I think it's a good choice. Kevin Smith, you know, is one of my favorite directors and podcasters, and he's always said, you know, Ben Affleck could play Jaws in a remake of Jaws.
Man, we already discussed that. We are not taking it that far.
I like
it. Hey, although he was great in Jay and Silent Bob.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of Superman, there's a really interesting new art exhibit, and it uses the name Superman, but not quite in the way we're talking about. It's called SID, Superman is Dead, acronym. And so Sid Vicious, you know, he is the Sex Pistols bassist who died at 21 from a drug overdose in 1979.
Sid and Nancy, yeah.
Yeah, he was really the face of that group.
Right.
And those 2 years he was with the band made him a living embodiment of the genre's live fast, die young kind of aesthetic.
Leave a skinny looking corpse.
Yeah, right. So there is a really interesting new exhibit in Los Angeles. Okay, so just imagine this. You are in an art museum and you walk into a scene and it's an exhibit showing like a recreated destroyed hotel room. With a shattered TV on the floor and a shredded pile of photos and Bible pages and soda cans and broken furniture and all that stuff. And then just down the hall, Billy Idol and the guys from the Sex Pistols, Blondie and Adam and the Ants, they're playing covers until late into the night.
Oh, wow.
That was what happened on the opening of the show.
Well, that would have been a wild scene.
Yeah, that would have been a wild scene. It's put together by Shepard Fairey. I don't know if you know him because he's a contemporary street artist from L.A. who's known for the Barack Obama Hope poster that was big.
Wow. And, is that behind that?
Yeah, in the 2008 U.S. presidential election. He was the guy behind that. And so he put together this exhibit with photographer Dennis Morris, and it's quite something. So it has like the photography and that scene that they did and some prints and all sorts of stuff, all inspired by Sid Vicious's life.
Wow. That is an amazing story. And it was he was quite of a sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
I mean, iconic figure, you know. Yeah. He's like up there with Jim Morrison, Elvis Presley, you know, all these guys, you know, who came in, went hard.
But I would argue different about that, because I, you know, even though he is in the, you know, the same, you know, live fast, die young genre, you know, with Jim Morrison and Jimi Hendrix and...
Yeah.
But
he didn't die at 27, I guess.
Right? Yeah, but there's a big difference, man. You know, Jim Morrison and Jimi Hendrix, those guys were very talented.
Right. Exactly. Well, yeah, because with Sid, a lot of it was just the icon of what he was portraying and, the image of it. And he wasn't necessarily known for his fine work in terms of the musical ability.
Yeah, he didn't have the musical attributes. I mean, and I give you an example. I mean, can anybody here hum a few bars of their favorite Sex Pistols song?
I wanna be anarchy.
Well, yeah, but you remember that song because you remember
that's
that song.
That's not humming.
Yeah, you remember that song because it was a big hit for the Motley Crue. But the only song that
Motley Crue did it.
Yeah, the only song that. The Sex Pistols did that, you know, people I would think remember is just a Johnny Rotten doing the, you know, God Save the Queen. She ain't no human being.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I you know, you're right, though. Sid Vicious, you know, he's got that iconic status because, you know, and one of the things that they leave out in this art exhibit is they don't mention the fact that he murdered his girlfriend, too, the same night.
Right.
Yeah, that tends to get glossed over in the history. Well, you know, that's the thing is, you know, Sid was like the face of punk. You know, then that's
definitely.
Like you said, it wasn't exactly super talented. When I think about Sid Vicious and Johnny Rotten, you know, the Sex Pistols, I think of the line from The Dark Knight, where Aaron Eckhart said, you know, you either die the hero or live long enough to see yourself become a villain. I recently saw Johnny Rotten was putting his Malibu home up for sale, and it looked like Martha Stewart lived there. And I was just thinking about the contrast between, oh, you know, Sid's life and Johnny's life.
You guys ever see that show, Californication?
Yeah.
With David
Duchovny.
Right. Have you seen it?
Yeah.
Well, you know, in the show, there's a guy who plays, the guy who I'm talking about that Tim mentioned? Who plays the rock star in the show Californication? He's got the long blonde hair, and he's a piano player.
Yeah, he's a comedian.
Yeah, he's a comedian. He really is a very talented musician.
Very funny.
Yeah, but there's in this Californication, there's a guy, the older guy with glasses and you know dark hair, and he plays Tim Minchin's character. He plays his the road manager for the band, right? Well, that's the dude from the Sex Pistols.
Steve Jones.
Steve Jones, yeah. He was the guitar player from the Sex Pistols.
And that he's on Californication?
He's on Californication.
Crazy.
Yeah, he's like a 60-year-old overweight guy. And, right. And that's what he plays.
Yeah, well, so I wonder, you know, Warren, who works here, his band used to open for the Sex Pistols. And, you know, Warren's pretty laid-back kind of guy. Yeah.
Cool.
I wonder what Sid would have been like if he had survived into his later years, what he would be like now.
Yeah,
who
no
knows?
Kidding.
You never know, because like I don't think the Sex Pistols would have went that far because they just didn't have any talent. They were just a phenomenon.
Yeah.
Ferry, who's the one who put together the exhibit, he said something that was striking to me. He says, I was a sucker for Sid's image as a teenager and still am, even though I see him as less cool and more tragic and cautionary these days. People are so scared to show those emotions, so they live vicariously through Sid.
Yeah. Well, you know, sure. And I think rock is dead, maybe, you know, and it... As a civilization, as a people, I mean, you know, we had this thing from like the 50s until now where like, you know, we witnessed this stuff. But now it's like it's all been played out, you know, the whole 27 thing, you know, and we've made a transition. You know, now we have Kanye West as the new rock star.
Well,
We're not going back to the Sex Pistols.
Genius.
It's going to have to become something different.
Well, yeah, because the music's changed and things change, but somebody else will come along who will equally shock and it'll be equally as cool, you know. And to
Lady Gaga
generation.
Or something.
Yeah. It could be, you know, any number of people. But I think the image of, you know, total violence for violence's sake and
nihilism
and drug addiction,
anarchy
is a cool thing. You know, it's just not cool anymore. People are like, hey, I, you know, I've grown accustomed to breathing in and breathing out. I like living. Yeah. You know?
It was that era, and it's no longer in that same.
Yeah, he's an icon. You know, in that respect, it's like a slice of history. You know, the world was a different place then. We were a different people. He's a representative of that. Like I said, the nihilism of that time period for those people. They've all moved on.
And a lot of it has to do with just art in general. Because there was a time when it was very involved, you know, for artists to die young,
mm-hmm.
you know, painters.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Know? Or cut their ears off.
Writers. you know? Yep, absolutely.
They would do bizarre behavior, you know, I mean, like Salvador Dali and, you know, Picasso and all these guys, were quirky. But it's not a fashion anymore.
Yeah.
Been their own mental balance in terms of this.
The industry can not have to pay royalties, and they can promote, you know, an artist who's dead. They can say anything they want without worrying about the guy refuting or changing what the label has to say about him. So
I think it really comes down to is that, you know, we've evolved. When I say we, as a, you know, human beings listening to music and stuff, that we've evolved to. And we do a lot of this on this show, to where, you know, you don't have to be a punk or do something revolting, you know, to get noticed. You can get noticed for your own musical attributes. You know, we've had people on from all around the world on our show, like Wouter Kellerman and, you know, Kevin Lucas and, you know,
Arun Shenoy.
Ricky Kej. Yeah, you can just be talented and make beautiful music. You don't have to dress as a clown.
And have that identity of something that isn't genuine.
Right, exactly. And like even with the younger generation, like my younger daughters, they like, Taylor Swift. And, you know, people like that. And but Taylor Swift doesn't have to go out and do something as outrageous as Miley Cyrus.
Yeah, right. I was about to say, some skilled musicians sometimes end up falling into the trap of creating identity.
Controlled chaos, right?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, that's right. I do know what time it is. It's time to get the answers, everyone. And when I need to know, I go to Jerry Renfro. He knows. So listen up, higher education is coming our way. Now I love it. And, God bless America.
Where do you go when you need to know? Go to Jerry Renfro, he knows. Where do you go when you need to know? Go to Jerry Renfro, he knows.
That's right, I'm not Jerry Renfro, and I am not the guy in the know. But I am here to tell you about some fascinating things. And for all of you who are just starting to figure out that there's a thing called social media, well, let's explore that a little bit, okay? Now, we know that there's some very big sites in social media, roughly about 15 of them. There's Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, Pinterest, which I don't understand at all, Google+, Tumblr, Instagram, Flickr, MySpace, is that still around? Meetup, AskFM, Meet Me, Don't Meet Me, Classmates, just the list just goes on. So, since all of our audience wants to know about what's going on, some of the things that are in the know, we thought we'd pick a few and tell you, you know, what it's all about. Like, for example, High Five. I don't know if you've heard it or not, but it's the fastest growing social networking site in the world. For the first half of 2008, High Five was the largest site of its kind. You may have heard of it. The site grew 78% in the first half. Based in San Francisco, High Five launched in 2003 and is turning a profit by 2004, and by 2005 had 10 million members. While sites like Facebook and MySpace began to dominate the U.S., High Five began to look at other opportunities internationally. In 2006, it launched the Spanish version. And LinkedIn is a social networking site designed for professionals. Or at least that's what they say. Well, I'm here to tell you I'm part of LinkedIn, and I'm telling you half the people I hear are not professionals. It boasts a membership of more than 35 million people and claims that executives from every Fortune 500 company has member profiles on the site. The site focuses on members, professionals, experience, and skills. But does everyone use it to their full potential? Maybe, maybe not. I'm sure there are people who have an account on LinkedIn that do nothing more than accept the occasional introduction to connect. Twitter is a phenomenon that I cannot figure out. Part website, part web service, Twitter is an online environment where users can create profiles, fill them with the information, and then build a network of people they follow and people can follow them. Twitter sends messages between users via short messages, SIMs, you know, SMS. The whole vernacular of, you know, to tweet in 140 characters or less is just something that's taken on. Now, Facebook. It was founded in 2004 by Mark Zuckerberg. And, you know, at Harvard University, we've all seen the movie. We all know the story. We all know the online community is all about where people can, you know, exchange not only just photos and profiles, but they can invite each other to social events. They can create social conflict. And there is really nothing people cannot do. I've seen it, you know, work where people have reconnected with families and family members, where they have developed a relationship, where they have started a war. What is going on with Facebook? In short, Facebook has become the most visited social networking site in the world, receiving more than 10 million unique visitors, and that's making it the number one social site in the world. That's 10 million unique visitors going onto that site every 10 seconds. Oh my gosh, and it's only 10 years old, so where does it go from here? Well, that's a look at some of the top social networking sites, and now you know.
And that's your art and entertainment news. Keep listening for Downpour's special feature.
To speak to the man, the myth, the legend, and the Black Panther, Bobby Seale, in this interview with the president of Just Imagine It, Inc., Charlie Stanton.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another exciting interview on Get Behind Me, Now Stay There. Today, we're privileged to have on Bobby Seale, the founder of the Black Panthers. He's going to tell us all about his upcoming movie and what's been going on with him this past year. Carson Bench is here with us from KSKQ. He's the program director, and he's going to be interviewing Bobby. Hey, welcome, Bobby.
Hello, good morning, afternoon, rather.
good afternoon, sir.
All right. Well, Bobby, as Charlie said, my name is Carson Bench, and I'm the program director at KSKQ 89.5 FM. We're a small volunteer-run community radio station in Ashland, Oregon.
And, yes.
Okay. You know, I know you have a movie that you're trying to get some funding for called Seize the Day, but if you would...
Seize the Time.
Seize the time. Okay. Sorry about that.
Now, wait a minute. Seize the Day... is Richard M. Nixon's book.
Okay, that'd be very, very different. So,
well, it's very different because he wanted to seize the time, but when they went through the annals I had published, you know, way back, you know, he realized that seize the time was mine.
So once again, you beat him to the punch.
Yeah, and the film I'm doing is going to portray Richard M. Nixon in his own voice. I mean, we really have this. We researched this all this stuff so good, of him talking to J. Edgar Hoover. Old Watergate tapes has finally been made public access, you know, and telephone conversation tapes that Richard M. Nixon used to tape all his conversations, telephone and whatever. And he had called J. Edgar Hoover, and he says, "Well, J. Edgar, did Mitchell talk to you?" Mitchell was the United States Attorney General at the time, and then Richard M. Nixon. He says, about getting rid of these Black Panthers. We really got to get rid of these Panthers. And this is what Richard M. Nixon is saying to J. Edgar Hoover. And J. Edgar Hoover says, well, sir, he hasn't called yet. He says, well, he's going to be calling you. And we want to expedite this situation. So,
yeah, for all of our young listeners out there, Richard M. Nixon was the president of the United States during the...
Right, right. And I guess... my history is anti-fascism, okay? Here is the president of the United States of America, right after he's elected November of 1968, after he's sworn in early 69, and he's talking on the phone to J. Edgar Hoover yet again. Again, this is the second time he'd met with J. Edgar Hoover. And it's this thing, this president wants to get rid of us. Now, we haven't been charged with anything, et cetera. So the counterintelligence program of the FBI, most people don't know what this is. They call it COINTELPRO, but it was the counterintelligence program of the FBI. I mean, it's like J. Edgar Hoover sent out, my God, to 43 district offices of the FBI. In the United States of America, 43 district offices of the FBI, you know, the headquarters in Washington, D.C., at the Hoover Building. But the point is, he sent out these messages. Now, we got these documents from Senate investigation hearings and investigation. Senate investigation hearings had subpoenaed these documents back when they was criticizing the FBI for attacking my Black Panther Party offices all across the country. And you know, we got killed. You know, we had to shoot back and defend ourselves. And then, of course, finally, we won all the cases and won all the trials and stuff like this here. But the thing is, that was fascism on the part of the United States government. Richard M. Nixon at the time, J. Edgar Hoover carrying out what the President of the United States had ordered.
Bobby, yeah, I was wondering, how long have these documents been available and the recordings available?
Well, I think these old Watergate tapes became public record back here several years ago. You know what I mean? They became public record. I mean, you could get a hold of them now, you know.
Yeah, I think certain amount of them were made available to the public. And then after Nixon died, I think they all became available.
And what was the process that you had to go through to make these, you know, available
to
you?
Well, it was my research people, my producer director. He was doing the research, you know, and he does all this stuff. And he went through Library of Congress and all other kind of places and got information on this stuff. And then actually got a download of Nixon in his voice and J. Edgar Hoover in his voice and one of the Watergate tape phone conversations that Richard M. Nixon had with J. Edgar Hoover. It was just a research process, that's all. The information is there. And there was so many other documents, you know, print paper documents that the United States Congress had subpoenaed. And they put the FBI on the hot seat for 10, 12 days because they were running around using police forces in local cities and the FBI working with them to attack Black Panther Party offices. I mean, they came to our offices at the night, early in the morning, busting in doors, et cetera, shot up people, killed December 4th, 1969, shot, killed, and murdered Fred Hampton. My screenplay opens up with the murder of Fred Hampton.
Wow.
It opens up with the murder of Fred Hampton, how the police and the FBI orchestrated that night.
So you're going to make us all feel like we're there in the 60s with you at the start of this movement.
That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to place you there. I'm going to get a young person to see us. We're young folks. We're avid readers. We're researchers. Boom, boom, boom. And, of course, we know the racists will attack us, et cetera. We all have guns. They are legal guns, though, by the Second Amendment of the Constitution of the United States of America. I mean, we have that if you come in here shooting at us, we're shooting back.
Oh,
you're not going to come in here brutalizing us, shooting us, and killing us. Now, if you want to make an arrest, we will take the arrest. Make a formal arrest, and we'll take the arrest. And then, of course, we had one of the best legal teams of lawyers all across the country. We networked all our lawyers. In fact, I called a couple of retreats for lawyers to pull together. Those who were defending our white left radical friends and our Black Panther Party friends and everybody, you know, I pulled the lawyers together. I said, look, we got to look at what our history is, what our programs are. These are the ground levels where we're coming from. So you got to be able to argue this kind of stuff in court, you know, that kind of stuff. So these are the kinds of things. And most people don't know it. They arrested thousands of us over a period of time. But most people don't know. Most of those charges were dropped and thrown out of court. And those that did go to court and go to trial, we won 95% of all our courtroom cases in the cross country. 95%.
That's a huge percentage, 95%. Obviously, that says something about what was really going on at that time
They were trying to repress the protest movement. And the Black Panther Party had become sort of the vanguard of the overall 1960s protest movement, somewhat. I mean, young white left radicals, they told us we were the vanguard. We were out there battling and trying to do programs at the same time, you know. It was mean history. When I say mean history, I mean in the sense that it was fascism coming down on us, but we had the audacity and the mindset and the intelligent mindset to stand on the right to self-defense. You can't just come in here trying to brutalize us and shoot us. Now, if you want to take the arrest, we take the arrest. We take the arrest, we bail our people out, we go to court. But when we get ready to come to court, you know what I mean? These guys ain't got nothing on us. I mean, all they did was trying to repress us. Well, they were disturbing the peace. Well, they had automatic weapons. And the judge says, these are not automatic weapons. These are semi-automatic weapons. They're legal. yeah, but these are AR-16s that they use in Vietnam. And then the judge says, well, the Ku Klux Klan is on the outskirts of Los Angeles in the woods with the same weapons. How come you ain't out there arresting them?
Really?
These are legal weapons. Judge threw the crap out of court. You shouldn't even come down here. Now, they attacked our Los Angeles office, and it was well fortified because I knew through a process, because I instructed my Black Panther Party members, and I have retreats, and it's coming, and I want you to fortify the office. And I'm an old architect, and I'm a carpenter, a construction builder, you know. And I'd show them, you know, by design, et cetera, what to do, how to fortify places, how to build out a foot and a half from your build walls and fill it up with sand. If you can't fill it up with sand, fill it up with rocks, dirt, everything. Get down behind these things. So when the cops come and start shooting, you know, the bone. So the L.A. shootout lasted 5 hours. I mean, the cops were shooting that for 2 or 3 minutes and stopped. 20 minutes, shooting that for 3 or 4 more minutes, stop for half an hour, shooting that. Boom, boom. That's what they were doing. Now, finally, 11 a.m. came, and some news reporter 3 blocks away on a roof has a zoom lens. He zooms in on the surrender flag that the Black Panthers have stuck out there. And the news reporter said, the Black Panthers have been trying to surrender since early this morning at 7 o'clock, and here it is, 11 o'clock, and the police have ignored the surrender sign. Well, that caused all of our people we network with all across the country, all the movie stars, all the few politicians that supported us, all the other organizational groups, everybody from the NAACP, the Urban League, whoever, et cetera. Even the African-Americans Black Policemen's League supported us, the Black Panthers, and criticized FBI and the police.
Wasn't Marlon Brando one of your supporters?
One of our great supporters, one of our early great supporters. I mean, my God, yes, he was. I mean, this guy was around before all these shootouts ever happened.
What kind of guy was he?
He's a great guy. He was a great liberal. He believed in people's human constitutional, as I used to articulate it, constitutional, democratic, civil, human rights for everybody, whether you're Black, white, blue, red, green, yellow, a polka dot. Constitutional, democratic, civil rights are supposed to be enforced for everybody. So our slogan was all power to all the people, not the racists, not the Ku Klux Klan, not the avaricious racist politicians who would send their police forces down to attack us. They're not supposed to have the power to take away our human rights, our civil rights, you know what I mean? It was all part of the 1960s protest movement, that civil human rights period, and it was a piece of dynamic history. You know, we started the Black Panther Party in October 1966. I resigned 8 years later, you know, in 1974. But when I resigned, there was only 200 people left. 2 weeks after I resigned, there was only 50 people left in the whole Black Panther Party. So it was over. You know, it did it. It made its contribution, et cetera. And I mean, I went on to have my own radio show back east somewhere, you know, and the Bobby Seale show and that kind of stuff. And then later I went to work for Temple University in Philadelphia. But I'm just saying.
So, Bobby, when you resigned, are you saying a lot of people left because you left? Or are you just saying that the Black Panther Party as a whole was losing momentum?
No. Earlier, 2 years earlier, there was a strategic organizing mistake. And that mistake was breaking down all the chapters and branches and trying to get them to come to Oakland, California, to live and work there, particularly on my mayoralty campaign. I ran for mayor of Oakland. When we gave the directive to all chapters, and it took several months, that you break down, bring all your resources, bring all your membership here to Oakland. We're going to reorganize, and you want everybody to be in the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Area, because Bobby Seale will be running for mayor of Oakland. And if we can take this city politically, you know, electorally, we would be, because we registered so many thousands of people to vote and was doing that. Well, we lost 2/3 of our 5,000 membership. We lost them. They did not come to Oakland. After I lost the mayoralty campaign, which is a year or so later, then the 900 or so that came from cross country, they more or less dribbled back and went back home, went back to college, et cetera. And, of course, there were no shootouts then. All the shootouts had stopped. We had won that situation with the shootouts.
So, young people, get your education. Bobby
yes.
Seale told you. Hey, Bobby, it's been an honor to talk to you. I appreciate the time.
All right. Thank you. Thank you. People know that they can go to my website and they can contribute. And they can see a lot of perks for any contribution they make for early development funds for my film.
Well, thank you so much for coming on again, man. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. It's always time well spent.
And thank you so much, Bobby. We'll talk to you soon.
To learn more about Bobby Seale, visit us on our website at justimagineitinc.com. I want your skull.
The band Adult Toys have a new album, Black Stream. They tell us all about it in this interview with the president of Just Imagine It, Inc., Charlie Stanton.
I love that guy.
Welcome, everybody, to another exciting interview, rock and roll edition. Get behind me now, stay there. Today, we're really pleased to have on Adult Toys, and they're talking about their album, Black Stream. And we have all three members. We're very fortunate today. We have Carlos, Mickey, and Chris. How are you guys doing?
Great. Thanks for having us on the show.
Oh, we're very, very pleased to have you on.
Cool. At some point, probably there's going to be somebody delivering a pizza.
Beautiful. Save me a slice. Now, you guys are in Southern California, correct?
Sunny Southern California. Yeah, well, it's not 100 degrees today, at least.
There you go. I mean, yeah, what a shock. It's not 100 degrees in Riverside. Now that we have everybody on the same page weather-wise, let's talk about your band, which is, you know, really, I really like your music, and you have that album out, Black Stream. So let's talk about Black Stream first before I get to the obvious question. Where did you ever come up with that name, Adult Toys?
Well, Black Stream was one of the alternates.
Well, you know, the Black Stream might have been a little more internet friendly. I can tell
you that. It's a little easier to search for.
Yeah.
Whatever, you know, it looks funny when you like us on Facebook that you like Adult Toys.
Yeah, exactly. And who doesn't, you know?
Most guys.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about the album.
All right. If any of you guys want to chime in, geez. We recorded it here in Riverside at home.
It's an at-home recording. We have a studio in the back. It's where we do all of our work.
Chris does all the engineering and production, because he's like that.
I am like that.
He does lead drums and recording.
Yes, lead drums.
He does lead drums and recording, and there's a wild rumor on there he even does background drums. You know? Let's just narrow it down to Chris Connolly does percussion.
There we go.
Yes, he does percussion for Adult Toys. And he also plays in a band, but you know, hey.
But it's pretty basic, you know. We just kind of like, we practice in the garage, and it's kind of like, I have cool neighbors, apparently. Nobody complains. And
well, they like the music.
I hope so. Well, except for maybe one of the neighbors next door that we call Miller Time.
They at least don't hate it, so we got that.
That's true.
Well, now, for all of our listeners out there, you know, what song on the EP that you just enjoyed the most? Like, it didn't care if you play it 100 times a night. It's just always fresh to you.
Chris, you first.
They're all like little children. But there's not a lot that we don't record that we wouldn't mind playing every night. So for me, but if I had to pick one, I would say maybe Drift or Trees. It's they're both really solid. Really fun to play on drums.
Okay, and Mickey, what about you?
Blush Response.
Okay, well that was quick. I'm gonna kind of guess that you wrote that song.
Sure. I'm not the politician that Chris is, but yeah, that's my favorite song, man. I can play that forever.
Okay, and Carlos, what about you?
I'm gonna have to go with Drift. That's like a lot of fun to play and sing at the same time. Yeah, it's a lot of interesting stuff going on at the same time while we're drifting and doing all cool stuff.
Drifting the night away. So
yeah, all right.
Good song to play.
Well, okay. Well, you know what? I'll tell you what we're going to do. We will, since the three band members cannot agree on a song.
Oh, out of three said Drift.
Two out of three said Drift. So let's hear a little bit of Drift right now.
Drive away,
Okay, everybody, that was a Drift, and that's on the album Black Stream. Now, where can people find your music when they're going to buy it?
You can download it right now from Bandcamp at adulttoys.bandcamp.com. We can also be, you can be linked to it from our Facebook, which is facebook.com/adulttoysca, letter C, letter A.
That's for California.
Yes. You know, that is for California, but I got to tell you, I just did an interview with a band in Canada, and that's the abbreviation for Canada, too. Oh. Yeah, there you have it. See? And you thought this was not an educational show. Yeah. Now, the album's out. Are you guys touring in support of it? Are you playing around the Riverside area? Do you have any plans on going on the road, maybe opening up for some other acts?
Well, we still have some other stuff that we're still recording, actually. So we've been, actually, I think we finished the drum tracks for all of our songs at this point, haven't we?
Yes, yes.
Finally.
All drums are finished tracking. We need to wrap up the rest of the tracks, and we'd actually like to do something small in support of it. But right now we're keeping it local.
Yeah, bands can't really make any money nowadays unless they have like some sort of merch, and we're trying to put all that stuff together and kind of sit here and butt heads and decide what to name an actual album or what to put on it. It's like figuring that stuff out actually seems to take about as much time as recording sometimes.
Well, you know, I can give you a suggestion on a place that I think you guys would be perfect at. Well, actually, there's a couple of them.
In Portland?
No, in California, CA. But if you wanted to leave Riverside County, go down to Orange County, there's a place called the Coach House, which is very small and intimate, and a lot of big-name acts play there all the time.
I saw George Carlin there once.
There you go. I mean, I saw, you know, many, many, many different people there. I saw Johnny Winter there. I saw, you know, Rick Derringer there. I saw Robert Plant play there, you know. I mean, they just, all the bands go there and try out because it's such a...
Baby, 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 baby.
Exactly, yeah.
In the small room.
Yeah. He wasn't, you know, quite as good as you were, but...
It took us a while to put, like, our Facebook stuff together. And, you know, nowadays, like, for bands to play, everyone kind of wants a URL or, you know, nobody wants a CD anymore. It's a totally different thing out there now. So now that we have that put together for the most part, it's a matter of sending people emails nowadays, you know? Yeah. It's weird.
Yeah,
you know, there is a whole different, you know, everyone still enjoys music and they still, you know, want to hear it. It's just that the way we get it now has changed, you know? It's gone from records, tapes, CDs, and now it's a digital platform. And but I find that people still want CDs, you know, they just... You have to have some sort of a presence for them to know. And the digital is the easiest way you can get it out, you know, across the world. I would highly suggest that you make your music available on digital and then do a CDs on demand. When people want to order them, they can just order them, and then they will just, like a CD baby or somebody will just cut them and mail them to them.
Well, we have some super secret ideas on how to, you know, merch out some music.
Well, I'll tell you where you're going to sell your most CDs, and that's at your concerts.
Yeah, and that's usually, lately, that's really where I've been buying CDs. I don't go to record stores anymore to buy them. It's weird.
Well, yeah. We would if they existed.
Right. I was going to say, you know, you're going to a record store.
If there were many around to support still.
Yeah, the last one standing in Riverside, California.
Mad Platter,
yeah,
I think.
Mad Platter. Yeah, Mad Platter is the last local record store.
Which isn't cool.
Well, you know, record stores have kind of gone by the way of the drive-in movie theater, you know?
I don't know. I think everyone's going back to tapes.
Yeah, tapes. Going back to sets. Old cassette decks.
Maybe 8-tracks. As far as touring along with the EP that we put out, we've been kind of doing some local shows and really trying to figure out who will have us outside of Riverside. It's kind of weird. In other bands I've been in, you know, people wouldn't go next door to see a band in Riverside, you know, from Riverside. Mm-hmm. If you're like in LA or something, you know, it's really weird out there. And there's still like a weird pay to play thing that pops up every once in a while. It's really kind of like, it's like you've stepped into a time machine and you're trying to book your band in 1989 or something.
Yep.
Well, you know, that's kind of interesting because, you know, Riverside is such a big place. And for all our listeners out there, no, Riverside is huge. It's not only geographically huge, but there's a lot of people there. There's got to be close to a million people there.
It's a big city. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's the Inland Empire.
But it's got a small downtown.
Yes.
Actually, I've gone through tiny, tiny towns that have, you know, a downtown that's miles long. And then, actually, Riverside's got a very small downtown. It's very compact.
It's a very sprawling city, but as far as downtowns go, you know, traditional urban city-wise, it is very small.
They got some more bars.
Lots of bars.
Yeah. There you go. Adult choice at a bar near you. You know. Well, you know what? I wish you guys all the success in the world. And, you know, we're certainly glad that we found you. And we want all of our listeners to go out and pick up a copy of Adult Toys' album, Black Stream, the EP. You can stream it online, and it's available at www.adulttoys.bandcamp.com.
That's pretty good.
Yes.
Yeah.
With more to come.
With more to come. And, you know, like I said, we wish you all kinds of success. And, you know, hey, when you get your album finished, man, you need to come back on and tell us all about it.
Absolutely.
All right, thanks, guys. It's been great talking with you.
Thanks for having us.
All right. Hey, enjoy that pizza.
It's coming right now.
Oh, there it is. All right, man. Have a great evening.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, bye-bye now.
To learn more about the rock band Adult Toys, visit us on our website at justimagineinc.com.
Orson's Shadow, Sir Laurence Olivier, Orson Welles, Vivien Leigh, Joan Plowright, Kenneth Tynan. When these champions of the theater get together to rehearse Ionesco's Rhinoceros, mere mortals best step aside. With lightning wit and scathing insight into the true nature of genius, Austin Pendleton's new play opens the private worlds of these very public people, exposing their warmth, their egos, and their glittering madness.
Oh, Ken.
What?
I feel bad for you.
Well, you mustn't.
Did Orson fuck Rita Hayworth, Ken?
I beg your pardon?
I heard he fucked Rita Hayworth.
Well, he was married to her.
Oh.
He fucked other film stars.
Who?
If I tell you, will you let me into his dressing room? I hope he doesn't take me up on that. I'd have to take him through the history of Orson's sex life, which alone would keep us here longer than a performance of the Oresteia. And then I suppose we'd talk about his film career, and that would be a scene of exposition. Oh, Christ, do we all know what exposition is? I hope not. I hope your minds are filled with knowledge more nourishing than that. And really, you see, that's how we are in the theatre. We assume that ordinary, decent people, people who have actually things to do, that they think about the things that consume us day and night. Exposition is the spoon-feeding to the audience of the what has happened to the characters before the play began. So, let me use one of the cruder engines of exposition that England has developed. The maid who answers the telephone at the beginning of the play. Hello? Oh, I'm sorry. Mr. Welles has stepped out. Well, you see, he's walking on the moors. Well, I don't know how long, you see. He's brooding. Why? Well, because in 1941, RKO tore up his contract after he directed Citizen Kane. How many years ago was that? Well, 19 years, wasn't it? Because you know what year it is now, don't you? Oh, you don't? Well, it's 1960. What is Citizen Kane? The finest film since they brought in sound. Well, that's what the gardener says. No, it made no money. And you know what they did? They took away his final cut on every film from that time on.
What's Final Cut? Well, Mr. Zanuck, Final Cut is where they leave the film just the way he likes it, and they don't put those happy endings on. Breaks his heart, those happy endings. Well, the gardener says it's because of how he lost his mum to the jaundice when he was 9 years old. Poor little tyke. Now, that will provide a few facts for those of you who have never heard of Citizen Kane. And it really makes me weep with relief to realize that you exist, because when one is around Orson, one tends to forget that...
This is an LA Theater Works full cast performance featuring Carolyn Goodall, Glenn Headley, Martin Jarvis, Robert McCrae, Orlando Seal, and Simon Templeman. Austin Pendleton is an American film, television, and stage actor, a playwright, and a theater director and instructor. For more information about top-selling titles from this award-winning company, go to downpour.com. Get Behind Me, Now Stay There, is a Just Imagine It, Inc. presentation and was recorded in the Blackstone Audio, Inc. studios in Ashland, Oregon. If you would like more information about this show, or if you or someone you know would like to be featured, please call 541-708-0525 or visit justimagineitinc.com. I'm Jerry Renfro.
I'm Sarah Simerson.
I'm Chrissy McIntyre.
I'm Maya Seligman.
And I'm Charlie Stanton, and we like you, so be sure to like us on Facebook. And remember to get behind me.
Now stay there.
My high anxiety is getting higher. It feels like I'm gonna blow. Yeah, gone is the breeze. It used to be so sweet.
Poison is the